This is Joe Basso from Music Radar, the place for music makers, and I am speaking with Ted Nugent, Terrible Ted, the Nuge, the Motor City Madman. Am I leaving any nicknames out?
Well, some that you can't say in the air, but our greetings to you, Joe. Happy Independence Day every day.
There you go, man. By the way, who thinks up all these nicknames? Is it you? Is it somebody else?
Well, the first Motor City Madman reference was back in the roaring 60s, the 1960s, when I was on the road, you know, 350 days a year. And CB radios were the big deal on the highways of America for communication amongst us travelers. I communicated for, you know, geographical considerations, expeditious traffic flow, and the location of the occasional smoky. And one guy asked me my handle one time, I think it was 1967 or so, and I just blurted back the Motor City Madman. And one of the guys in the band heard it, and he referenced it, you know, later on, and it just kind of picked up steam. But I think it was both spontaneous and appropriate.
Now, you recently played your 6,000th concert.
Ouch! Boy, that hurt.
First off, who did all the counting? And B, was the 6,000th and 1 concert a letdown?
Well, first of all, we celebrated the 6,000th concert at what we thought was the epicenter of all things Uncle Ted, Detroit Motor City, high energy rock and roll. That was at the Pine Knob Music Theater outside of Detroit, because that was the convenient place to rendezvous with my guitar teacher from 1958, Joe Podorsik, who I first performed live with playing the song Honky Tonk. The actual 6,000th concert did just take place recently, so I'm on my 6,003, I think, right now. But I got to tell you, we went back and reviewed. We found boxes. We lost our home in Michigan a few years ago to a terrible infestation of mold and dangerous conditions. So we gathered up some of our belongings from our barn and our garage, and somebody stumbled upon all the old tour guides and all the old tour books and all the old tour lists. I forget who it was. I think it was probably a bunch of us, my daughter, my son, myself, and my assistant. They reviewed it with my management, and they went, "My God, he'll do his 6,000th concert this year if all these statistics are accurate." And based on the feeling in my joints, I think those statistics are accurate. So that's where the number came from. We added up all the shows I started doing in my youth, and the nonstop 300-plus a year from 67 through about 77. And even during the damn Yankees years in the 1990s, we were doing 200 concerts a year. So, you know, it's funny, but being clean and sober keeps you really healthy. It keeps you conscientious, which drives you to be healthy and take good care of yourself. I eat properly. I've never put any poisons in my system. No drugs, alcohol, tobacco, even though I do like a good glass of red wine on occasion, especially since I find out that it is actually good for you. But the energy today is indescribable. With Mick Brown on drums and Greg Smith on the bass guitar, my songs have never been more intense. They've never been this tight. They've never been this energized or with such piss and vinegar and authority. I could not be more proud of my music in 2008 than I've ever been. And that is in light of the fact that I've always been surrounded by the best musicians the world has to offer, just absolute world-class virtuosos every step of my amazing career. And I thank all those dedicated musicians. But today, we have reached a new pinnacle, a new high of rhythm and blues, emotion and intensity and fun. And I attribute that to Greg Smith on bass and Mick Brown on drums. It's just every guitar player's dream, and I live it every night.
Speaking of guitar playing, how do you approach the guitar? You mentioned that you studied guitar back in the day. I mean, do you still study? Do you play to records? Do you ever work on pure technique?
You know, I never do work on pure technique. I did in the very early years, just trying to emulate my heroes, the Bo Diddley grind and the Chuck Berry fluidity. And eventually I got to jam with B.B. King and Freddie King. And I actually played with Bo Diddley, and I played with Chuck Berry, and I played with Stevie Ray Vaughan and Eddie Van Halen and Billy Gibbons. And I was in a room jamming with Jimi Hendrix and Rick Derringer and Johnny Winter. So I really have been to the mountaintop of musical communication, particularly from a guitar player's point of view. Considering all that guitar influence, I am equally influenced by everything from Junior Walker and the All-Stars' amazing sax lines and sax melodies to the musical collisions of John Coltrane and Sun Ra. There is no music or sound or emotion or human experience that has not found its way into my music. So it was important that I physically approach the instrument so that I could maneuver my hands upon the neck and really hang on to that Gibson Birdland handcrafted archtop hollow body guitar. But the real influence in my music is one more of spirituality, emotion, sexuality, the human experience. I'm a very gregarious guy. I love sharing campfires, both figuratively and literally, with people from everyone from wounded heroes in Afghanistan and in Kandahar and Iraq and Fallujah to training with the Navy SEALs and the Green Beret and the Army Rangers and the Special Ops to conducting federal raids against fugitive felons with federal agents in Texas and beyond, and the burying of a loved one and the singing an emotional song to a terminally ill child, to the sexual adventure of my youth, to the sharing of a campfire with naked Africans on the Limpopo River and sharing the sacred flesh of a hunt that we killed together, that life-sustaining protein with sharp sticks in a most aboriginal primal scream setting. All this goes into my guitar playing, which keeps it raw, it keeps it primal, it keeps it honest. It's just absolutely, inescapably honest. And most importantly, spontaneous. My music is not reviewed or considered or scrutinized. My music flows like a stream of spirituality. It's a sacred, uninhibited, irreverent dynamic between the inspiration of all the black influences of my early music to the masters that I am privileged to collaborate with on a nightly basis, like Mick and Greg. And it literally has a life of its own, and that's why every song I've ever written and every jam I've ever partaken in starts with my guitar making a grinding, rhythmical statement. I cannot pick up the guitar. I cannot pick up the guitar, Joe, without creating an infectious, grinding, danceable guitar line, and that's the essence of my musical life.
I want to touch on two things that you just mentioned. First off, your guitar, but then I'm going to get to a political thing. You've mainly played Gibsons your entire career, Les Pauls, but especially the Birdland.
Yeah, especially.
Ever think of playing a Tele or a Strat? I mean, Jimmy Page and Jimi Hendrix got some pretty killer sounds out of those.
Yeah, he certainly does, and a lot of my heroes got some astonishing sounds on the Strat. I've only played the Strat, the Fender Stratocaster, on one song ever in my recording career. And that was on a song called Working Hard, Playing Hard, mm-hmm. where I got almost like that Dick Dale and the Deltones, the Ventures Pipeline kind of sound on the a low E string where I get the kind of grind going. And then I played I have a beautiful 1953 Strat that was given to me by Al Nally Music in Ann Arbor many years ago when we would tour together with his band, the incredible Brownsville Station. And just the timbre of that Strat is what needed to be on that particular song. But I do play a lot of Paul Reed Smith guitars because they are absolute pieces of musical art. But that Gibson Birdland is inspired by Jimmy McCarty of Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels way back in the late 1950s. Continues to not just inspire me, but to milk and mine unlimited musical adventure from that very unique hollow body jazz guitar. And I do believe that God invented the Gibson Birdland for me.
By the way, what amp do you put that through?
For the last 20 years, I've discovered that the threshold of that biting and fat, greasy barbecue tone that I love, that's personified on Stranglehold and on the newest album, Love Grenade, and the song Girl Scout Cookies, that the Birdland and my old Les Pauls and the PRS, they really have the biggest, richest, nastiest sound from the PV amplifiers, especially the 5150 and the new 6505s. A combination of those and their classics gives me a very biting top mid and also that just roaring animal bottom end. So I really love my PV amps too.
Now, if you love the Birdland so much, as you obviously do, I saw a video of you recently where you sacrificed it as a buffalo with a flaming arrow. Why would you do that?
Well, first of all, in the great tradition of my good friend Chris Angel, the illusionist, I promise you, Joe, I would never sacrifice a Birdland for anything. That is a, I suppose I could keep it all secret, but that shooter guitar is actually a replica of a custom all-white Gibson Birdland made by their custom shop that I performed Great White Buffalo and a few other songs on. For the mountaintop climax of the story of the Great White Buffalo and how his spirit keeps people autonomous and keeps people accountable, the ultimate use of the spiritual buffalo is to sustain oneself with his sacred flesh. And so in the great Aboriginal celebration of my hunting lifestyle, I've set that guitar up on a stand, and I draw back my bow and put a flaming arrow through it. And you got to admit, that is exciting.
What if you miss?
Well, let's keep praying that I don't.
Now,
actually, I did miss one time at the damn Yankees. I used a little trigger release on the bowstring. It's a mechanical release that's been around forever, and it gives you a consistent release, which is critical for the final departure of the arrow from the bow. And one night, that trigger release, shall we say, had a premature unleashing of the arrow. And that arrow, I believe, is still in the Meriwether Post Pavilion ceiling.
Now, Ted, you speak very reverentially about the black musicians who have influenced you.
One must, yeah.
Yet, you are, correct me if I'm wrong, what I would call a very hardcore right-wing Republican guy.
Well, old guard Republican, not the current wishy-washy Republican. You know?
Okay, but the new guard has not exactly been exactly preferential towards African Americans. How do you rationalize this?
Well, I think you've just made a terrible miscalculation. I believe that the new slave owners of the modern world are liberal Democrats who literally force this welfare slavery and hold people down. And then if you really examine the demographics of those that are held down by the lie of welfare that has been created by liberal Democrats and liberal Republicans, those are the real racists in America today. I was watching a show just recently of, I believe, correct me if I'm mistaken, but I think it was actually the Black Republican Caucus. I know it was a huge assemblage of black senators and congressmen and politicians who were represented by, and again, I hope I get this name properly, and I hope the designation is accurate, Reverend Lee Peterson, who, though I had completed my new book, Ted White and Blue, The Nugent Manifesto, including a chapter that I wrote called Black Like Me, because I live the best that I can in the shoes of my black musical heroes and my black hunting heroes. And regardless of one's color or ethnicity, one would have to admit to the statistics that Detroit is the manifestation of an intentional choice of cultural deprivation by a black community where the mayor elected is a gangster, a known gangster, even prior to his election, and the result and the horror of that denial, putting such a horrible leader into position only because of his color, in defiance of Martin Luther King's dream. Detroit has the embarrassing soullessness of only graduating 1 out of 4 Detroit children. That's racism. My universally embraced dream, universal by people of conscience, people of goodwill and decency, that is best represented by those speakers at this recent Republican Black Caucus, is literally word for word the chapter in my Ted White and Blue book, Black Like Me. And that is that welfare is slavery, and that to encourage the increased bloating of Fedzilla as the answer is not about independence, is not about equal justice under the law, which is not about equality. It's about identifying a segment of the population and literally telling them that they're not good enough to make it on their own. So I would like to think that in the final honest analysis, that what Ted Nugent represents and everybody that I know represents is that we are absolutely colorblind. We believe that the opportunities that exist for my son and your son and my neighbors exist for every American today, and it's proven by everybody from Tiger Woods and Oprah Winfrey and Bill Cosby and Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, and you could go on and on and on and on.
What about Barack Obama?
And Barack Obama is another perfect example. There is excellence in the heart and soul of everybody in America, and it needs to be encouraged and cultivated and not compromised via social programs that literally send a message that you're too stupid to make it on your own, so we've got to lower the bar so that you people who are squaring for the American dream might want to get up early and work really hard like all the people we just mentioned.